You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1997, a small team of finance executives at J.P. Morgan dreamed up a financial instrument that has, in less than a dozen years, brought Wall Street and the global economy to its knees, credit derivatives. Joining me now is Jesse Eisinger, a senior writer for Condé Nast Portfolio, whose article about credit derivatives, the $58 trillion in the room, appears in this month's issue, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hi, Jesse. Good
Hi.
To see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Last time you were here, you were working for me. It's terrific to see you doing
interning.
This.
So finally made good.
Let's get right to it. What are credit derivatives? Are they essentially a form of insurance?
Yes. There's a form of credit derivative called the credit default swap, and that's the most prevalent form. And it really is simply a insurance contract between two people. So if you're worried that your position, your stock position, say, in General Motors is vulnerable, that the company might go bankrupt, you will buy a credit default swap. You'll buy protection.
So this is really to diffuse the risk.
Exactly. But it's turned into a speculative instrument.
What is the securitization of loans?
So the securitization of loans is a different type of financial engineering. It emerged in the 1970s, and that's a bundling of loans and doesn't have to do with derivatives, but became very common in the 1980s when Michael Lewis wrote about them in Liar's Poker. Really what this is taking, say, 100 or 1,000 mortgages, say, any type of loan, credit cards, bundling them together and slicing them up into different risk tranches, they call them, risk slices. And what it does is it exposes you to a certain level of the losses. If you have a big risk appetite, you take the first losses, and in return you're supposed to get high returns. And if you have a low risk appetite, you take the highest tranche.
So this is something that banks liked.
Banks loved them because they could buy loans or take their own loans and bundle them up and sell them to investors, and therefore they would lower their risk.
Well, the one of the central characters in this whole story is a man named Bill Demchak, and he led a team at J.P. Morgan. What did he do with these loans? He combined them more than they had been combined in the past?
Yes. So Demchak was worried in the late 1990s that J.P. Morgan had made too many loans. And not only that it had made too many loans, but it had made too many promises, credit lines, offering credit lines to companies all across the country and the world. And they were worried that they had too much exposure. And so he wanted to move some of the loans off J.P. Morgan's balance sheet, but he didn't want to sell them, and securitization was too difficult because he didn't want to alienate his customers, these blue-chip companies. In some cases, J.P. Morgan himself, John Pierpont, had founded the company or had originally banked the company. And so what he decided to do was form an off-balance sheet vehicle. I won't get too complicated, but he combined securitization, which was a financial engineering technique that people had been using on Wall Street for several years, with a burgeoning new form of credit derivative called credit default swaps into this complex entity that essentially allowed them to be protected from default.
So they're the creators of what are now just being called credit derivatives?
They created that first complex structured vehicle. There had been, as I say, securitization around, and there had been small credit default swap transactions, first in the early 1990s from Bankers Trust. Really, they created this first technology, and then what they did was they became essentially the Henry Ford of the this area, this market. They industrialized it.
But Bankers Trust went belly up in 1994, partly because of doing something like this. Wasn't that a warning to anyone who was thinking of going further in this direction?
Absolutely. Bankers Trust had big problems selling misleading credit derivatives, or not, excuse me, derivatives contracts. Mostly they were interest rate derivatives at that point. And people have been warning about derivatives ever since. A few years ago, Warren Buffett famously called derivatives financial weapons of mass destruction. But they were so profitable and for Wall Street, and they seemingly spread risk around in a way that made the world safer. at least proponents thought so, such as Alan Greenspan.
So they just ignored what people like Warren Buffett had said? In fact, Bill Demchak claims that credit derivatives have spread and morphed in ways that he never intended but always feared. So he knew that there were problems from the start.
I think that these guys, the people at J.P. Morgan were very prudent bankers. If you had credit derivatives solely in the hands of bankers like Bill Demchak, I think we could all sleep easily at night. But what happened was in moving these loans off the balance sheet, they created a template for other banks to act in the same way, and those other bankers were much less responsible.
So that's why J.P. Morgan Chase is not one of the companies that's in trouble today, even though they started this whole thing.
You know, they have a new CEO from a couple years ago who didn't grow up at J.P. Morgan, but I think that the culture of prudence that where they learn to move risk off their balance sheet actually sort of permeated the culture, and I think that J.P. Morgan lives in the slipstream of this bistro deal that I'm speaking of, and in some ways that's why they have been prudent, but they have a lot of risks because they've got an enormous balance sheet full of derivative contracts.
In the article you say, in effect, J.P. Morgan was paying insurance premiums to investors who now were on the hook if one of Morgan's clients went belly up. So they were really asking their investors to protect them if they screwed up.
Absolutely, and that's what this whole risk spreading was about.
So everybody saw that and said, hey, I can take real chances, and if I use a similar system, adopt this system, I'll be protected.
Yeah, before this
isn't happened, that a house of building a house of cards?
Well, the idea was that before this, only banks made loans, and so only banks had credit risk. And so if you were, say, if there was an oil problem in Texas, all the Texas banks would go under because they had lent to people who were buying homes in Texas and oil companies. And this way, you would spread the risk around so that insurance companies would have some of it and hedge funds would have some of it, and to each would be according to his risk appetite, so to speak. And so you would have a little bit of risk in oil companies going bad, but it wouldn't only be Texas banks.
Well, you're right that Morgan's derivatives project began in the wake of the Asian financial crisis in 1997 as an attempt to protect the bank from bad loans. How could derivatives have helped to alleviate the damage that was done by the Asian financial crisis?
Well, J.P. Morgan didn't alleviate the damage. They took some losses, but then what that did was spurred them to look around at their balance sheet and all the loans that they had made and all these credit lines to these companies. And they realized that in a crisis similar to the Asian financial crisis, if it had hit in the United States, for instance, all these blue chip companies would draw their credit lines down at once. And that's exactly the wrong time that you want to be lending as a banker when there's a crisis. And so they decided, you know, we have so much exposure here and potential exposure here. We've got to figure out a way to do this, but we can't alienate these firms. So we have to do some elaborate form of financial engineering.
So they were fooling everybody, including themselves to some degree?
You know, I think that they were that Wall Street clearly has been delusional about the ability for them to spread risk. I think that in that first limited transaction, J.P. Morgan really did spread the risk around. So, and what the
watching thing, Bankers Trust and saying we're not going to do the same sort of thing.
Yeah, well, Bankers Trust was, they had J.P. Morgan had elevated and evolved the transaction to be a little bit more sophisticated, and that was their revelation, their innovation. But this was the kind of thing that was a good idea in a limited way at the beginning. And that's what I found interesting about the story was that it wasn't a bunch of Wall Street crooks bent on ripping off their clients from the get-go. It was a way for bankers to act more prudently. And then it has morphed and expanded and grown to ways that
were
wildly imprudent and dangerous and have really brought down the global financial economy.
My guest is Jesse Eisinger, who is a writer for the Condé Nast Portfolio, and his article, The $58 Trillion in the Room, is in the current issue of that magazine. The J.P. Morgan called the Demchak's project credit transformation. So did it change the way that we understand credit today?
Yeah.
It transformed?
It totally transformed this idea, because no longer did banks hold all the credit risk in the economy so that you could spread it around and everybody would get a little bit of it.
And they created a thing called Bistro. What is Bistro?
So Bistro was this groundbreaking credit derivative structured finance transaction. In the lingo, it's called a synthetic collateralized debt obligation, which of course is a mouthful. What it was an off-balance sheet vehicle where they put their loans into this vehicle, and then they sold credit default swaps. They bought credit default swap protection. Even I get confused sometimes, from the vehicle itself. So investors bought tranches of the vehicle, and J.P. Morgan was protected in the case of default from that. And if you have followed that, I give you kudos.
No, I don't, but I'm still stuck on something being off the balance sheet.
I think that's a great thing to be stuck on. It's the kind of thing that normal people, civilians,
I thought everything goes on the balance sheet when you're, especially if you're a banker.
The most dangerous thing that happened in the last 15 years in finance is that we moved lots of loans off the balance sheet and pretended that that banks and other financial companies had gotten rid of the exposure to them. And then it turned out that in crises, that all those loans rush right back onto the balance sheet, and you've actually made way too many loans, and you don't have enough capital against them.
So that's part of the delusion. You're looking at your balance sheet and saying, oh, everything is great, and then one day suddenly it all hits you that it isn't so great.
Exactly. If you have really sold the loan, if you've truly gotten rid of the exposure, that's one thing. But if you've only made a sort of contingent promise to get rid of the loan, but you'll take it back under certain circumstances, then you haven't. And collectively, our financial system did a lot of that kind of financial engineering.
What does it say about the companies that bought into this wholeheartedly and the ones who didn't? Goldman Sachs was pretty circumspect, wasn't it?
Well, Goldman really has bought into this kind of financial engineering whole hog, but they've been more nimble about anticipating problems in the market and were really able to hedge themselves. Unlike, say, Merrill Lynch, which really retained a lot of the exposure, even though it was pretending that it had moved off the balance sheet. I want to clarify that the credit derivatives are not the sole problem of why we are in a global financial meltdown. They didn't cause this necessarily, but they exacerbated it because everybody was so confident that they'd moved risk off the balance sheet that they could take more and more risk.
But your article states that Standard & Poor initially gave some of J.P. Morgan's new investments bad ratings. How did the bank contend with the ratings agencies?
Well, they initially didn't want to rate them, and then they negotiated with J.P. Morgan, and S&P finally did rate the transaction. And this is one of the central problems of the financial world, that we had an over-reliance on credit rating agencies. Credit rating agencies, of course, are the credit rating agencies are the Wall Street banks.
So they're rather close to the Wall Street banks.
They
want to please their clients.
In my view, there's a terrible conflict of interest between the Wall Street banks and the credit rating agencies, and that led the rating agencies to be vastly overly optimistic about the structured finance transactions, including most of these mortgage securitizations.
Should the government have been overseeing this cozy relationship?
I think the government is going to have to step in and
now
and they should
this
have.
Isn't
they
this
should
like
have
locking the barn door after the horse has been stolen?
Absolutely. There's no question there. But there was a great failure of government oversight. What they did was they essentially outsourced the regulation of this entire market to the credit rating agencies, which were the de facto regulators, even though their customers were the Wall Street banks.
Did the government regulate credit derivatives at the time that Bistro was created?
No, and this is another failure of regulation, in my view. The another J.P. Morgan executive, sort of in parallel to Demchak's effort, was the head of the trade group, the credit derivatives trade group, ISDA. and he was a chief lobbyist. And in conjunction with Wendy Graham, Phil Graham's wife, who was the head of the CFTC at the time, and Phil Graham himself, who was a great proponent of deregulation and lack of regulation.
He was the head of the banking committee, wasn't he,
exactly,
in the Senate at the time?
And throughout the 1990s, they staved off regulation of the derivatives market. So credit derivatives, the entire credit default swap market today is unregulated. And I think that has led to problems.
How has John McCain been able to distance himself from the fact that Phil Graham has been a major influence on his economic thinking?
That's a very good question.
I don't mean to ask that as in a political way, but everybody is looking under every rock during this this campaign, and I would have thought that would have been a problem.
Yeah, he was defenestrated for calling the nation a nation of whiners and that we were all having a mental recession, Phil Graham, but from the campaign. But he's been one of the major economic advisors to McCain and been one of the godfathers of financial deregulation. The problem, I think, is twofold. One, it's enormously complex, and two, the Democrats were in power in the 1990s, too, Clinton, obviously, and they were deregulating the financial markets as well.
In fact, Alan Greenspan was ahead of the Fed during the Clinton administration. He's now in testimony before Congress, apologized, did a serious mea culpa. Companies like J.P. Morgan, all the others, they were also fighting against regulation, weren't they?
Yeah, I find Alan Greenspan's admission that there was a flaw in his views just astounding. I feel like it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves because we have been operating under an ideology for 30 years that said markets would solve problems.
But
correctly.
What about some of the other warning signs? For example, there was that massive credit derivative swap. There was that whole issue in Orange County that involved that. I remember when Orange County went bankrupt and they blamed one guy for it. But wasn't that just another example of this kind of trading?
Well, that was interest rate derivatives, not credit derivatives. But it was a warning sign. And the warning sign was ignored, just as long-term capital management, the hedge fund that blew up in 1998, was also a warning sign about how tied together the financial world was getting. And I think that my argument about Bistro is that Wall Street was complex and tied together before that, but this was the moment that it went into warp speed, and all these firms became so tied together and interlaced that none of them could fail because it would make the financial system too vulnerable.
Well, people have been asking how well-run insurance companies like AIG could get into this whole thing. The AIG is still doing very well in all of its other branches, but they have taken a big hit here, and this has hurt them with all the rest of their business.
Well, I think this is a perfect example of contrasting regulation with deregulation because AIG is in both regulated insurance businesses and credit default swaps, and in credit default swaps were unregulated. And what happened was it ended up writing over $400 billion worth of protection, credit default swaps, without putting adequate capital against it. And of course, in insurance businesses, you do have to put up capital because you're regulated, and you have to put up capital to satisfy policyholders. And so when they were given this opportunity in an unregulated business, they wrote hundreds of billions of dollars worth of insurance contracts, essentially insurance contracts, and then they didn't have adequate capital against it when those bets went wrong, and that's what took AIG down.
A listener asks, wasn't Sarbanes-Oxley supposed to prevent items and risk from going off balance sheet?
That's a great question. Of course, Enron had a lot of off-balance sheet vehicles, and so the idea was that in the reforms post-Enron, mainly Sarbanes-Oxley, that they would try to move everything on balance sheet, and it was totally unsuccessful for the financial industry.
They hated Sarbanes-Oxley, didn't they?
Yeah, Sarbanes-Oxley was attacked for every week for the since the day it was passed, and people were saying that New York was going to lose out on its competitiveness because of this, and you know, I think in fact investors are finding out what the value of a highly regulated market is.
Well, we have a situation now where Goldman Sachs is allowing itself to go into more regulated areas.
Goldman Sachs has transformed itself from an investment bank to a bank in order to save the company. It was possible before they did that Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley could go bankrupt, which is almost unthinkable because Goldman is really a solid company. But there was essentially a run on the bank, and they had to curtail it. So they, by transforming into a regulated bank, they did that.
Why did it take so long for this whole thing to fall apart? It was obvious that there were serious cracks. Were the companies involved still making believe that there were no problems? Were they hoping that somewhere down the line some miracle was going to happen?
It's a very good question. I think it has to do with it's hard to know when a bubble will pop, and it's hard to predict it. And the living is good while it's inflating. And the housing bubble was really the thing that precipitated the credit crisis.
And well, is that related? Isn't the housing crisis related to this?
It's absolutely related to it. So one of the things that encouraged the housing bubble was that Wall Street firms were ready to buy mortgages from mortgage companies to bundle into securitizations that would go into other securitizations that use credit derivatives. And it got complex beyond all human reckoning, and also incredibly levered, so that people were putting so little down and having so many assets against very little capital. And so that's really what happened. It just sort of, the financial system was so precarious, it eventually tottered based on this very tiny corner of the market, subprime mortgages to people with poor credit histories, cracking. That's a very small portion of the population, and for them to have problems and bring the global financial system down just shows you that it was much bigger than subprime. That was really a symptom of a larger problem.
Some people are saying that the failure of investment systems like Bistro herald the end of market fundamentalism, what you call the dominant ideology governing the financial world since the Reagan administration.
I think we're undergoing an enormous rethinking of how we structure our economy. We've essentially nationalized the biggest insurance company in the world, AIG. The government has invested in banks. We've taken enormous stakes in banks. And in return, we're going to have to order our financial regulatory system. And I think that is going to have to lead to some reassessment of our view that markets solve problems efficiently.
So is this a form of socialism? Because right now Barack Obama is being accused of threatening
yes.
to bring socialism to America. But what we've just seen has been brought to us by George W. Bush.
I think all financial reporters are flabbergasted that that this would have happened under a Bush administration. And one of the problems in they came to the solution late, that the solution being to invest equity into banks because of their ideological blockages, that they didn't see that that was a solution because they were so ideologically opposed to it. But it's a stunning state of affairs, and I think that the realization is that there are no ideologues in foxholes.
So what happens now? Do we go back to square one, or is there going to be a whole new system that's going to have to be developed?
I think it's a great question. So either we beat back the financial industry.
Go back to 1960 or something.
Well, yeah. Either, you know, it could be like a redux of the Sarbanes-Oxley fight, which is that after some nominal regulation and change in the law, the financial industry manages to go back to the way it was, the heyday. And I think that's going to be the defining battle in the financial world, which really affects the the real world over the next couple of years. My view is that we can't possibly go back because this has been too cataclysmic. We really have had a terrible market crash here. So I think we'll reorder the financial regulatory system so that we require banks and other financial companies and hedge funds to have adequate capital. They take much less leverage. There's much less borrowing throughout the financial system, and that will make it a more stable system.
Well, we said that we put a lot of safeguards into the system after the crash of 29, and this sort of thing couldn't happen again. Are we going to have to do the same sort of reordering now?
The 33 and 34 acts led to decades of a stable financial system. So I think they were great accomplishments, and we need to update that. Whether we can accomplish it, I'm a little pessimistic because our political system is so broken and so ineffective that it doesn't seem like it rewards optimism about this. But I think it's so cataclysmic, as I say, that we'll probably get to something.
Before you go, a listener wants you to comment on the Glass-Steagall Act.
That's an interesting question. The Glass-Steagall Act, in my view, didn't lead to these problems. So the Glass-Steagall Act, its main issue was to break down the walls between investment banks and commercial banks. And in fact, that had been happening for years beforehand, and it essentially just codified an already existing reality. And in my view, in fact, that's led to some stabilization, because you've seen Bank of America, a commercial bank, bought an investment bank, Merrill Lynch, so Merrill Lynch didn't have to fail. So in fact, of the deregulatory moves of the 1990s, I don't have a big problem with Glass-Steagall. I think the real problem was that they made regulation toothless. There are laws on the books, except for credit derivatives, but they didn't enforce them.
But when I think back to the old days, there was a time when banks were limited to the state they had been established in. And that was it. Maybe Chase had a branch in Chicago because another one in Los Angeles. But they were really a New York bank. Another bank was Bank of America was not a national bank. None of these banks were national banks. Have they become too big, which makes them more vulnerable?
There's no question they've become too big. So it's entered the lexicon that we talk about entities being too big to fail. And what's happened is the global financial world has become so intertwined that no one is too big. Everyone is too big to fail, even a tiny hedge fund, it seems. That's a slight exaggeration. But many, many financial entities are related to each other and make the financial system much more vulnerable. We're never going to go back to having local banks, and it's a global financial world. We can't return to that.
I did know something was up when Washington Mutual and Wachovia suddenly started appearing. I had no idea where the heck they were from. Well, Washington, I had a good idea, but
sure,
Wachovia.
Branches on every corner.
Jesse Eisinger's article, The $58 Trillion in the Room, is in the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.